from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, diversity on the bench. Two-thirds of judges in California are still white and male. Change is coming slowly, but what difference does it make? Also, the drought reignites an old fight, water for fish versus farmers.
Don't just put back fish and spend a lot of money trucking them around the river. Don't you want to get the river fixed to the point where you can have them go up the river instead of trucking them?
Plus, how carpenters and sculptors are cashing in on this weekend's Academy Awards, and a new art exhibit explores creativity in the Philippines.
The Philippines has been struggling for a long time, and I think that they are coming out now. The creativity, the sense of freedom, nationalism, it's all in this show.
It's the California Report. We begin today with the color of justice, or to be more precise, the color of justices and judges. There's a new report on the demographics of the nearly 1,700 men and women who preside in our trial courts, courts of appeal, and state Supreme Court. The survey finds slow but sure progress toward making the bench look more like our state does, and yet more than two-thirds of all judges across California are white males. So, what difference does it make, and why should we care? For that, we turn to Kevin R. Johnson, dean of the UC Davis Law School. He's the first Latino to head a University of California law school. And Dean Johnson, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, big picture, what do you make of these statistics just released by the courts, and what do they tell us about the state of California's judiciary?
Well, I think that there is some positive and there's some issues to be concerned with in terms of the data. It is amazing, and many people have observed that we have a California Supreme Court that is a majority female, and that's quite a difference from what it used to be and what it's like in many different states. However, we still see basically a 2-to-1 margin of males to females on the Court of Appeals and the trial courts in the state of California. And that's compared with about 50 and sometimes higher percent women graduates of law schools in recent times. The other thing that jumped out at me as I looked at the data is that there are zero African Americans and zero Latinos currently on the California Supreme Court, which in the past has seen people from those backgrounds on the court, but currently does not.
Well, and the governor is going to have an appointment to make with Joyce Kennard announcing her retirement. I guess you're saying the governor really ought to appoint a Latino or an African American.
Well, I think that there's not a litmus test or a racial litmus test, but I do think that if you're concerned about the representativeness of the state's highest court, there should be some effort given to trying to achieve some kind of diversity on the state's highest court.
And of course, in March, Hispanics are expected to surpass whites as the single largest group in California. They will make up some 39% of the population. And yet we have just 9% of the judges in California are Latino. What difference does that make in terms of justice?
It's hard to say that it has a direct impact on the outcomes of cases, but it does have an impact on people's view of the justice system. To the extent that the judiciary is not fully representative of the population, it looks less legitimate to many, many people out there, including many Latinos. I mean, we're talking a situation today where basically, 60% of the K-12 students are Latino and less than 10% of the trial court judges are Latino. When justice appears to be meted out by unrepresentative judges, I think that there's a concern about the legitimacy of the results and the possible racial injustice of it all.
Yeah. And yet justice is supposed to be blind. So is it? I mean, what difference does it make in addition to appearances, the backgrounds of a judge, the gender, the sexual orientation, the race?
I mean, I think when we're dealing with courts, especially when you're dealing with like the California Supreme Court or the courts of appeals, where a number of different justices make decisions, work together to make decisions, I think it can be very important, not just in terms of appearance, but in terms of the experiences, the background, the understanding, and the sensitivities to the issues that come before the court. And when you have a diverse court, just like when you have a diverse jury, the idea is that you have a better decision in the end, bringing together a variety of perspectives, a variety of thoughts, a variety of ways of looking at the world.
What would you say to critics who would suggest that, you know, the most important quality in judges is intelligence, experience, their understanding of the law, and that if you are just counting numbers, if you're just looking to diversify the bench, that you sacrifice quality of the judges? What would you say to them?
I think you unquestionably have to look at qualifications, abilities, as well as background and ancestry. I think it's important to have very smart people on the bench. I think it's important to have people schooled in the law, trained in the law, and able in the law. And I don't think anybody would really dispute that. I think people would also agree that those qualities can be found in women, in men, in minorities, and people from a wide diversity of backgrounds. And we should pay some attention to try to make sure that we look at all of the qualities of a potential judge. Nobody would suggest that, you know, excellence and diversity are totally separate and apart. I think people would say that you should consider many different criteria in deciding who should be a judge, but few would say we should compromise on excellence, that's for sure.
All right. Kevin R. Johnson, Dean of the UC Davis Law School, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, despite concerns about mudslides in Southern California, this weekend's rain is welcome relief from the drought. Among other things, the state's tight water supplies have put environmental restoration projects in the spotlight, especially the effort to bring salmon back to the state's second longest river, the San Joaquin. Republican House Speaker John Boehner is pushing a bill to kill that project. KQED science reporter Lauren Sommer looks at how this lack of rain is affecting one of the most ambitious restoration efforts in the state.
A huge flock of sandhill cranes, each bird 4 feet tall, is touching down at a wildlife preserve near the San Joaquin River. But they're not here for the river. In fact, it's hard to find the river at all.
This would be considered the main channel. This is it?
Yes, what you're looking at is the main channel of the river, and there's no water in it.
I'm walking across a dusty riverbed outside of Los Banos in the Central Valley with Monty Schmidt of the Natural Resources Defense Council. The drought is one reason we're not waist-deep in water, but it's not the only reason.
This is a highly altered river. The federal government built Fryant Dam and for 60 years dried up the river.
The San Joaquin runs from the Sierra Nevada all the way down to San Francisco Bay. But in the 1940s, a new dam near Fresno corralled the river to irrigate 1 million acres of Central Valley farmland.
Just that change alone had a huge impact on the river. Obviously, all the salmon were wiped out.
With the river no longer flowing most years, it was the end of the state's second largest salmon run, at least until recently. Schmidt's group sued the federal government and in 2006 signed an agreement that launched the return of Chinook salmon to the river.
Female. Adipose present.
Back in December, Matt Bigelow of California's Department of Fish and Wildlife examined a large female Chinook with a smattering of black spots. The fish was caught in the lower San Joaquin, where downstream tributaries get the river flowing again.
We take measurements on the length of the fish, and then we check them to see if they're ripeness for the males and females.
Ripeness, meaning eggs and sperm, These fish are trying to get upstream to reproduce, and they're getting some help from a kind of salmon shuttle service. Bigelow and his team load them in a tanker truck that hauls them upstream past the dry part of the river and releases them near Fryant Dam.
You know, obviously what we're doing right here, this is quite a bit of intervention to get fish up into suitable spawning habitat.
Gerald Hattler oversees the project for the state. Returning salmon to this river means moving them fish by fish right now because the river isn't quite ready for water to start flowing.
There's still a lot of things that need to happen. There's still substantial physical barriers to the fish moving upstream.
Crews need to screen off water pipes and intakes and put in drains to prevent farmland from flooding. Under the restoration plan, the river won't start flowing again until more of those projects are done. And they're behind schedule. That means the young that hatch from these salmon won't be able to reach the ocean on their own, at least not without a miracle.
If Mother Nature gives us a lot of water in the spring of 2014, we may see a large number of those juveniles make their way out.
The chances of that, slim to none. So the restoration team is planning to move the young salmon downstream in trucks, just like their parents.
The reality is it's not going according to plan.
Cannon Michael farms about 10,000 acres just outside of Los Banos. An old fork of the San Joaquin River runs right through it. It's choked with dry vegetation, but it's on the list for restoration at some point.
With the progress that they're making in terms of physical projects, this is way down the road.
Michael says there's been a lot of frustration. Farmers agreed to give up about 18% of their water under the restoration in exchange for new water supply projects and barriers to keep the river from encroaching onto their land.
Don't just put back fish and spend a lot of money trucking them around the river. Don't you want to get the river fixed to the point where you can have them go up the river instead of trucking them?
The first phase of the project is expected to cost $500 million, with the bulk of it coming from Congress. But with the economic downturn, appropriations have been slow. Still, after 8 years of work, Michael doesn't want to see the project in the political crosshairs.
Let's find a way to get people back on board with it instead of it being a divisive thing, you know, where the, you know, GOP maybe is using it as a tool.
Monty Schmidt of the Natural Resources Defense Council agrees.
The old model is to sit in court fighting each other. Instead, we all sat down and we worked something out that we all could live with and support.
Schmidt says he's looking at a drought bill from Senator Dianne Feinstein that could help some of these restoration projects get rolling. Even if that happens, the river wouldn't start flowing this year. Federal officials have said the flows will be cut because of the extreme drought. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Sommer.
This weekend's Academy Awards are all about glitz and glamour. But it takes real people to create that fantasy. In fact, award season is a real bonanza for the carpenters, welders, and sculptors who build the stages and props for Sunday night's broadcast. Reporter Caitlin Esch took a trip behind the scenes to see how Hollywood prepares for its close-up.
At Goodnight & Company, a set-building shop in the San Fernando Valley, sculptor Tim Baker is putting the finishing touches on small replicas of the Oscar statue. They look like they're made out of ice. They're actually made out of resin.
It's nice and clear. I use a vacuum chamber and suck out all the bubbles.
Baker has been up all night long working on the statues.
I have, yeah. It takes about 3 hours for each one, so... I just have just enough time to get a little nap in and then run the next one.
Where do you take your nap?
I have a little cot in the back.
Owner Beth Goodnight says her shop builds sets for just about everything. TV shows, commercials, music videos.
The jobs I enjoy the most are always the ones that are the most challenging. And one of the more difficult pieces was the 30-foot wide Lamborghini for the BET Awards. We had 10 days to build a 30-foot wide Lamborghini that they could dance on with a 30-foot windshield and 25-foot suicide doors, and it was fun.
And for the 86th Academy Awards, Goodnight production designer Sam Rimes built 1,208 oversized roses made from stiffened and treated polyester fabric.
You probably never want to see another rose again.
If you pay me, I'll do anything again.
This boost in business is coming at a great time for craftsmen like Rimes. Production work has steadily been leaving for other states. But Assembly Bill 1839, introduced last week, would incentivize big-budget films to move production back to California and provide more tax breaks to the entertainment industry.
There really has been an exodus of feature film work, large TV shows. There's been a lot of that going out of state. There's a ton of guys that are living this very gypsy-like, you know, existence.
Beth Goodnight says the Oscars and other awards shows make up about a quarter of the year's business. This season, Goodnight's mostly freelance workforce swelled from about 25 positions to more than 100. Craftsmen at shops like Goodnight and Company are executing the artistic vision of Oscar set designer Derek McLean. The theme this year is Heroes in Cinema.
Well, designing for the theme of Heroes is a tricky theme to actually, design for, because if you're too literal about it, I think you end up designing something that just looks simply grandiose.
McLean typically designs sets for Broadway, but last year he ventured into live TV. For the 85th Academy Awards, he designed a stunning stage inspired by the musicals of the 1930s and 40s.
Finding ways that evoke that, that don't feel pompous, I think is sort of the biggest challenge. And that, for me, requires trying to come up with something that you don't quite feel like you've seen before.
While McLean cannot give too much away about what this year's Oscar stage will look like, he can say it was a challenge. There will be about 10 different looks to the stage, rotated out during commercial breaks. Production designer Sam Rimes says growing up in Oklahoma, he dreamed about working on movie sets.
And I remember being a little kid watching Disney movies. And I didn't know the words for it, didn't know the terminology of it, but seeing these lands that they created. And just going, wow, I want to do that.
Rhyme says this Sunday he'll be watching the Oscars with all of his friends, feeling a special kind of pride. For the California Report, I'm Caitlin Esch in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles is home to the biggest Filipino population in the mainland U.S., but access to art from their home country is pretty limited. A new exhibit at USC's Fisher Art Museum gives Filipino Angelinos a rare chance to reconnect with the breadth of Filipino creativity. Alex Schmidt has a story about this collection. It's called The Triumph of Philippine Art.
A projector casts four images on a wall. It makes a clicking sound, and then the images spin as if they were reels on a slot machine. The piece, by artist Mark Salvatus, shows the gritty streets and graffiti of Manila.
Mark Salvatus was so fascinated to go to the city. He grew up in the countryside, and when he saw the city, he just started photographing it.
That's the exhibit's curator, Marisa Teresa Lapid Rodriguez. The show, called The Triumph of Philippine Art, opened first at Montclair State University in New Jersey, where Rodriguez works as a curator. It covers the period of martial law implemented under Ferdinand Marcos in 1972 through the People Power Movement that removed him and restored democracy in the 80s to the present day.
The Philippines has been struggling for a long time, and I think that they are coming out now. The creativity, the sense of freedom, nationalism, it's all in this show.
Other pieces in the exhibit include a long pencil sketch of a grand Philippine estate, drawn on a roll of toilet paper. And there's a video performance of an artist hacking at white laundry as blood spurts out and reddens the pile. It took Rodriguez 20 years to foster the interest and funds for an exhibit like this.
There was no consciousness about Filipino contemporary art. And that, for me, became a challenge.
Los Angeles is home to over 600,000 Filipinos, but this show is the first time some of them have seen art from the Philippines. Ivan Blanco is a fine arts student at USC, and he wandered in.
Well, I'm Filipino, so I figured I'd check out some art made by Filipino artists. I don't really know that much about my culture, as I thought I did, but kind of like seeing more art from other Filipinos is kind of cool looking, and it's kind of making me interested more in uncovering my culture.
A divide with the home country is common in the Filipino community. Geography is one barrier, says Evelyn Rodriguez, a professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. There's also the issue of fading into the woodwork as a distinct ethnic group.
Filipinos are also, I think, part part of this brown population in the States that a lot of people sort of homogenize, right? So people classify a lot of us with, you know, other Asian American groups or even Latinos. And so it's a community that has been invisible for a long time.
But in LA, that community has been creating distinct cultural capital for about two decades. There's Filipino-American painting, performance art, animation, a yearly cultural festival, and...
Hey girl, $1, $2, $3 and a dime, living in minimum wage, you're working double the time.
This Filipino-American music video screened earlier this month at a festival devoted exclusively to Filipino and Filipino-American music videos. The festival was co-sponsored by PhilAm Arts, which connects artists and stages shows and festivals around California.
Having more of these shows are really important because I think that it just solidifies our identity.
That's artist Tala Mateo. She works with PhilAm Arts and saw the USC Fisher Museum show. I talked with her outside the festival, near LA's historic Filipino town. She thinks an artistic identity can help the sizable Filipino population here be heard. And developing ties with the home country would also give U.S.-based Filipino artists an important historical reference point to draw upon.
Who we're a part of, who we're attached to, who we're related to. If we get lost in any way, shape, or form, at least we can hold on to that. And we know that we come from somewhere.
As she puts it, developing ties and understanding between the U.S. and the Philippines is a matter of survival on both sides of the ocean. Art can be one way to foster that. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt in Los Angeles.
New Orleans is gearing up for next week's Fat Tuesday celebration with its distinctive soundtrack of Zydeco music. But Northern California has its own Zydeco scene, the merging of Cajun, blues, and R&B. It dates back to World War II and the Creole migrants who came to work in the shipyards and to find other economic opportunities. KQED's Rachel Dornhell met up with a Bay Area musician, one of the few Zydeco ambassadors outside Louisiana, at the top of the art form.
My name's Andre Theory. I've been playing accordion since I was like 9, 10 years old. So that's what, 23 years.
Andre Theory grew up in Richmond's vibrant Creole community. The self-taught musician had front row seats to Zydeco greats like Clifton Chenier and Buzu Chavis.
My grandparents, they booked bands from Louisiana, brought them out, and they played at the local church in Richmond, St. Mark's, and that's how I got into it.
Theory's grandparents didn't just book the bands, they hosted the musicians at their home. Theory grew up literally sitting on the laps of giants in the scene. One of them took a look at the boy's long arms and predicted Theory would be a great accordion player. Still, it didn't always seem fated to be.
First part of my life, I didn't like the music. I went to sleep. And then one night, I just went up front of stage and started watching the accordion player, and I fell in love with the accordion.
Now, Theory is the Grammy-nominated accordionist who's recorded 7 albums up on the stage at church dances. Like at this recent Mardi Gras celebration at St. Finbar Church in San Francisco. People are on their feet, out on the floor, almost from the first note. Sometimes it's a line dance, 20 rows deep. Other times, people rotate through partners. Organizer Alice Guidry says the tradition has roots in big weekend parties people hold at their homes in New Orleans, where she grew up.
And they used to have what they call yard dances. So every Saturday, they would rotate having Zydeco dance at different people's yard. And we'd, when it was our turn, we'd all be out there dancing, just having fun.
Guidry says St. Finbar is home to a lively Creole community.
Born and raised in San Francisco, my name is Ty Coleman.
My grandparents were from New Orleans.
Coleman points to the diversity on the dance floor. He says it reflects how open the community is, and also its rich history. People who identify as Creole trace their roots to African, French, Spanish, and Native American ancestors. Coleman says the community's connection to their elders, though, is fading.
A lot of those folks have died off. They've moved on. They didn't really pass it on to the kids like me as much as they probably should have.
Andre Thierry agrees this scene is in transition. Northern California's largely white folk music scene helped boost Zydeco through the 80s and 90s. But now the hippies, as his grandmother called them, are also aging. So he's pushing to get younger people involved.
I'm going to show you the waltz and the two-step on here, okay?
For the past 2 years, Thierry has been working with a group of 5 boys, ages 7 to 9, in Marin City. One recent day, he shows up with new miniature-sized accordions and starts by drilling a few of the kids on the dance rhythms.
What's that?
Waltz. Two-step.
What's this?
One.
The buttons don't change. It's just how you play them. 1-2, 1-2, or 1-2.
At the end of class, Thierry plays accordion while the boys accompany him on the drums and the rub board, or washboard. None of the boys come from Creole backgrounds, and when asked what kind of music they listen to at home, the answer is hip-hop and R&B. Still, they name themselves the Zydeco Boys and are full of enthusiasm, like 8-year-old Kevin Callahan.
We learn different stuff every day, and we go places that we never went before, and we just start having fun.
The places they've performed include a music producer's holiday party, a community blues festival, and the St. Finbar's Dance.
Andre has 4 of his students here tonight.
The boys bound on stage, clutching snare drums and rub boards.
All right, we're about to play a two-step or something like this.
Thierry says despite the area's relatively strong Zydeco scene, it can't touch Louisiana, where top Zydeco performers are superstars. When he plays at venues that aren't exclusively Zydeco here, he feels some people's skepticism at first.
When they see an accordion and a washboard walk in the building, some people are like smirking and rolling their eyes. Then once the music starts, then you get their attention.
Thierry's goal is to get as many people's attention as possible. These days, he's got a busy schedule, including Mardi Gras performances around the Bay and an East Coast tour. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical director is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes David Weir, Chad McClymans, Lisa Pickoff-White, and David Marks. Our interns are Kate Hunts and Matthew Levin. Craig Miller was a contributing editor. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funding for KQED Arts is provided by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation and the members of KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2014 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.